When I was 8 and 9 years old, we went to a friend's place in Surrey. We were really good friends with them at that time. My parents were good friends with them at that time. It was a celebration, a party. So we went to this person's place to be in that space again. And we had ended up staying that night at that friend's place because my parents weren't sober enough to go back home. And all the kids that were there with her had ended up being put in a room where we'd sleep all together. And we'd slept there a few times in the past. But this one night in particular, when I was really young, there was this one person that came in to that room when I was asleep. And I remember waking up feeling that it was a dream and it was really dark. And this young gentleman, this young person had kind of woken me up by pressing his arms like onto me, onto my body. And I remember opening my eyes and seeing this person looking at me. And I remember having this feeling of fear, this feeling of pain, this feeling of what is happening. And then this person had ended up doing these sexual kind of actions that I wasn't familiar with at that age. And I actually ended up closing my eyes really tightly and hoping that it would go away. And then ended up waking up my eyes, opening my eyes again. And it was daylight. And all the kids were awake. Somebody was making breakfast downstairs in the kitchen. And I remember thinking to myself that maybe it was a bad dream. Maybe it was something that I always felt that it was a bad dream.
Even though the experience had left her deeply disturbed, Nati decided not to tell anyone what had happened to her.
I didn't tell anybody because I felt I didn't understand it. I wasn't sure. I would never had that conversation with my parents about respecting your body, about if you ever feel anyone that does any harm to you in any way, or if you feel scared in any way in a moment, to let us know. I hadn't had those conversations with my parents or had built that trust enough with my parents.
That wasn't the only topic they didn't discuss, though. Nati's parents had never told their children about the hardships they faced during their exile. Nati's questions were always met with evasives or silence. When Fabiana arrived in Canada, the country felt like a totally foreign place to her. She didn't know anyone, so she stayed home a lot. Unable to grow her own food, Fabiana felt she couldn't connect to this new land. And without any professional help, she and her husband were having issues coping with their past.
My husband used to have a lot of problems. He was maybe 20 or 25 years old when the war started, and that kind of affected him. He used to feel a little bit of rage, and that made him start drinking. Sometimes at the house, he would be drunk, and all that rage he had, he would take it out on us. He would take it out on the family. Sometimes he would hurt the family. So the children started being afraid of him.
My parents' relationship was, I feel, was full of a lot of tensions. I remember listening and witnessing to some of the arguments that they would have and not understanding where it came from, but only feeling the emotions that came from it.
All the tension, sadness, and silence drew Nati away from home. Feeling disconnected to her own family, she befriended other teenagers from troubled homes. At age 12, she became sexually active, and then she started drinking and doing drugs. Her parents didn't know what she was up to. She barely spoke to them.
My relationship with my parents during my childhood was, there was a lot of anger. I did not communicate with them at all about anything. I hated them. Like, I just, especially my dad, I hated my dad. I felt that he had brought all of this pain to me. I felt it was because of his alcoholism. It was because of the violence that he brought into the household that it drove me to where I was as a teenager. And my mom, I hated my mom because I felt that she wasn't there for me.
Nati still hadn't come to terms with what had happened to her as a child. She frequently had a disturbing dream about a shadow sexually forcing itself into her. But she hadn't considered the possibility that the dreams were based on reality. Everything changed one day when she ran into a familiar figure while picking blueberries with her mom.
I remember in a far distance seeing this figure of a man talking to my mom and I guess talking to the other family members there. And I remember just this feeling of fear just entering my body. I just became paralyzed. That paralyzation, similar to what had happened during that incident, I felt that again. And I was triggered by this figure and did not know what it was. And it wasn't until later, and I had like run into like the blueberry bushes and I had just hid there. I just stayed there. I didn't want to come out. And not until later on in the evening when that person had left and we had gone back home, I started to ponder on that question as to why I had felt that way. And I came to realize that this feeling really was connected to the dream that I had. And I didn't know fully then, but it was a start into opening that wound of understanding that this was not a dream. What had happened was real.
After realizing that she had been a victim of sexual assault, she confided it to her best friend, who encouraged her to deal with it. It was the first time Nati said what had happened to her out loud.
I cried a lot. It was the first time I had cried in front of anybody, and it was with her because I trusted her. She was the first person I really, really trusted, so she held that space for me to share my childhood.
Finally, being able to talk to someone about the experience proved helpful. But Nati still hadn't dealt with many of the underlying issues. She spent the next 10 years taking refuge in alcohol, drugs, and destructive relationships. By then, her parents had found a way to sober up by reconnecting with their indigenous roots. But Nati was convinced this strategy wouldn't work for her. Looking for a fresh start, she and her best friend moved to Montreal. But the new setting didn't change Nati's old habits. She continued to abuse drugs and alcohol. Her behavior eventually led to a fight with her friend. The fallout made Nati realize she had to fully confront what had happened to her as a child. So she went back home to tell her parents about it.
That conversation was very hard. It was one of the most challenging conversations I have had with my family. I remember all of us sitting kind of like a circle. And I remember nobody had any idea why they were there, why this was being initiated by me. I told them that I hadn't told them because I didn't trust them. I didn't feel they would understand her. It was more of trust. I just didn't trust them. And I told them that I had still hated them and had resentment towards them. So it was hard for me to share anything with them. So this was one of the first moments where I really shared something vulnerable to my parents.
Listening to Nati, Fabiana realized that keeping her children in the dark had created trust issues, so she decided to open up to them. After walking in the jungle for 8 days, Fabiana and her family finally made it to Mexico. But they soon realized they weren't alone. Thousands of people had fled to the neighboring country, where a makeshift refugee camp had been established near the border.
The United Nations had already arrived to help, but since we were thousands of people, we only got one or two tortillas a day. And that's not enough for a person. It's not enough to sustain a body. We didn't have any clothes. We didn't have cooking utensils. We had nothing. We went out looking for scraps, for anything we could use to boil some water. And that's when people started getting sick. One of my children died because he was struck by sickness.
The family was then sent to another refugee camp in the Mexican state of Campeche. They lived there for the next 8 years. It was here where Nati was born. The conditions were similar to the ones they had faced in the border.
Pero igual porque el lugar donde llegamos,
the place they sent us to was dry. Seco. The water, well, they would only give us a liter per person per day. And that's not enough. The food was the same, it was rationed. So I would give my children all of it, even if I didn't eat anything.
Slowly, Fabiana lost hope. She started thinking that the family would have to stay in Campeche forever. But one day, out of the blue, they received a letter from Fabiana's brother-in-law. He had emigrated to Canada before the family fled to Mexico. He initially thought they had died during the conflict, but after discovering his family members were alive, he helped them resettle in Vancouver. It was then that Fabiana and her husband decided they would never discuss the details of their exile with their children.
I think that if my parents had been a bit more open to their own experience, it would have been a more safer space for me to be able to share my experience, because I would have known that, wow, you've gone through so much. You can relate to my pain.
Nati's confession motivated her parents to finally share their experiences during the war. Understanding all the violence and trauma they endured for almost a decade has allowed her to put away her negative feelings towards them. She now embraces them for who they are. But Nati's commitment to break the silence goes well beyond her household. Now she's a social worker.
I'm very focused with youth and children because I realize the importance of the innocence, the importance of providing that nurturing space and empowering them as beautiful beings to see their true power and allow themselves to creatively explore it and connect with it.
Nati's family is still healing, but coping with decades of silence takes time and the help of every family member. Nati's parents don't drink anymore. The family has also found a place where they can grow traditional Guatemalan crops. Joining her parents at the farm has helped Nati reconnect with her indigenous roots. All of this makes Nati have high hopes for the future.
I'm still healing, so I see myself being a bit more liberated and free and working with a community, my community back home in Guatemala. And I see my family full of lots of love and joy, and I see them stronger. I see the roots of our household to be more grounded.
This documentary was produced by Carlos Tello and Aurora Tejeda with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. We would like to thank Nati and Fabiana for sharing their stories with us.
My best and most healthy relationship snuck up on me. I was in my late teens and started the relationship thinking I'd have a summer fling and maybe learn a little bit about dating in the process. I told myself, I'll dump him in September when school starts again. And then I ended up falling in love with him. We were together 5.5 years. Since then, I've had a string of relationships where the driving force was passion. It starts out strong with a blast of wild intensity and an all-encompassing fervor, but they end up being emotionally unavailable. I wanted to know what was happening and found some answers in attachment theory, which is research on the types of people we're attracted to and what happens when we get together. After delving into the attachment research, I started to purposefully date people who were better for me, but this came with much less excitement and passion. I found the process a little discouraging and a bit overwhelming. Dating like this was new territory. I became interested in doing a story on dating differently. I was curious about how this worked for others, and then I happened to bump into Mark at a party. He had gone through something similar, and he was willing to share his story. Mark and Eileen were set up by a couple of friends, and it was a bit awkward at first.
It was kind of a strange thing. It's, you know, when your parents tell you to talk to their friend's kid, it felt a bit like that, kind of a forced conversation.
As Mark will say, he felt obligated to talk to me.
Regardless, They ended up staying up most of the night and even took in the sunrise together. But it wasn't an instant connection. They went out a couple more times, but they didn't really pursue each other. After some prodding from friends on both sides, they start to date a bit more consistently.
In the beginning, I have to say part of it was that I kept thinking to myself, Mark's kind of crazy and he does all these wild things, but like he has very down-to-earth, lovely friends. And that was kind of like a stabilizing factor where I was like, you know what, I'm going to like see what's going on with this guy. Because I felt like he had some great characteristics. We had a lot of fun together. We had some stuff in common, but there were certain things like the lack of commitment and other things that would drive me a bit crazy.
Things like Mark finding it hard to commit to any plans with Eileen in case something better came along, or about how she'd barely see Mark when they went to parties together because he'd be off socializing and only realize he hadn't spoken to her all night when she'd find him to say goodnight. And these were the early days where you might expect just the opposite.
It was like pretty early on, like it must have been at like about a month or something. And I just said very casually to Mark, how do you think things are going? Which I thought was like a very normal question to ask someone that you had dated a bunch of times and seen a couple times a week for a month. And he like took this long pause and then he was like, well, I'd say I'm about 60% into you.
In my mind, I tend to think in terms of, I guess, too much like an engineer. And so I was tried to explain my rationale in terms of the way I'd been thinking previously about relationships starting at 100% and only dwindling. So trying to explain to her that, you know, I'm not at 100%, but it's increasing.
And I was so taken aback because first, definitely wasn't expecting a number. Like I had not expected him to like quantify it in numerical form. Secondly, I felt like 60 seemed like really low.
It's on the right side of 50% was what I was thinking. And it was only going to increase from there.
And he seemed like pretty delighted with this. And then he followed up by, no, well, it started way lower. I mean, I don't think like I'm an egoist, but at the same time, I don't feel like, you know, I need to be at a place where it's like, oh, well, look what the cat dragged in. Like, you know, I was also someone who's used to being a fairly high achiever. And to me, like 60 didn't seem that good. And I didn't really want to like know that. But that kind of speaks to Mark's like brutal honesty. He'll just say it like it is, you know.
Most of Mark's previous relationships started off quite differently. He was swept away by excitement and passion. They'd hook up and fall into relationship within a week's time, but they didn't last long.
I kind of notoriously had like a 3-month limit for my relationships and then would move on.
This is where attachment theory might come in handy. It's a psychological model that attempts to describe the dynamics of long and short-term relationships between humans. It's actually really accurate at predicting how people will behave in romantic relationships and whether they'll be matched based on their attachment styles. I found it immensely illuminating in my own life. It gave some context to the pattern I started to become aware of, one of being attracted to emotionally unavailable men and also being somewhat turned off people who were just the opposite and were available and present. Considering I've been a therapist for 10 years, you could say I came upon this info embarrassingly late, but I guess it's always easier to see what's happening in someone else's life than your own. There are 4 attachment types. People with a secure attachment are warm and loving. Relationships come easily to them, and they're great at communicating their needs and feelings. They're also comfortable with intimacy and independence. They're like the gold standard. People with an anxious attachment tend to be stressed out about their relationships. They love being very close to their partners, and they have the capacity for a lot of intimacy. However, they need a lot of reassurance and affection. People with an avoidant attachment style are fiercely independent and are often uncomfortable with intimacy. For them, the idea of commitment can be scary. They often construct their lifestyle in order to avoid commitment or too much intimate contact. So even though they want to be in relationship, they tend to keep their distance. The last attachment style is the combination of anxious and avoidant. With this type, the person is uncomfortable with intimacy and commitment, and at the same time, they have a strong desire to be in relationship. So how exactly do these attachment styles develop? They're actually formed through interactions with our parents as infants. Mark's 3-month relationships unfolded in relatively the same way. The first month was fun and full of passion. The second month, as Mark put it, they'd be coasting. And by the third month, things already started to feel a bit old. No longer in the honeymoon phase, he would get antsy and bored. Small superficial things that his partner did would start to annoy him.
It was really silly. It was just like wearing the same ratty pants over and over. It was just something that I noticed that stood out. No longer kind of this perfect image that I had of the person.
Through the attachment theory lens, our reactions to our partner's small imperfections would be seen as an avoidant type's distancing reaction to the idea of commitment. And this can all happen subconsciously.
And that's where I noticed also that it wasn't so much about the person, but it was also about me and how I approached the relationships. I realized if I want to have a relationship that lasted longer than 3 months, I needed to learn to appreciate those things and be able to accept how a person is. I think it was just realizing that after seeing that pattern numerous times that it wasn't sustainable and this can't be how you build a long-term relationship.
I asked Mark and Eileen to read over a summary on attachment styles to see where they identified themselves on the attachment spectrum.
Maybe Eileen can answer better for me.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. He definitely started out with feeling uncomfortable when things are too close and intimate and valuing independence and freedom. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. This is like classic. Mark is always surprised when I say something that I think is like completely obvious. I'll be like, oh, well, Mark really likes, you know, chicken. He's like, chicken? What do you mean I like chicken?
I guess I don't see myself in any boxes. So when someone sees me in a box, I'm always surprised by it.
Mark's reaction is understandable. Even though we may have a dominant attachment style, it's on a spectrum. So in most cases, we can have a bit of all styles in varying quantities. I take a guess that Mark would fall into the avoidant category. And Eileen sounds like a mixture of anxious and secure. You can see it playing out where Mark's more distant at first, and Eileen's looking for reassurance while still remaining grounded. I'm simplifying this all a bit, but you get it. There are predictable ways that the different attachment types tend to configure themselves into relationships. Secure types are capable of dating both anxious and avoidant types. They're comfortable enough with themselves to give anxious types all the reassurance they need and to give avoidant types the space they need without feeling threatened themselves. But opposites also attract. Anxious types are drawn to avoidant types and vice versa. For anxious types, avoidant types validate their abandonment fears and an insecurity of not being enough. In turn, avoidant types need someone to pursue them to meet the emotional needs that they subconsciously disown. I learned through my research that I was stuck in what's called the anxious-avoidant trap. I was the anxious one in this scenario. It was explained that I was attracted to avoidant types because they activated my attachment system. The attachment system is needed for survival. It's the system responsible for babies attaching to their caregivers. And it's the same system working in romantic relationships. So as an anxious person, getting mixed messages from an avoidant type and the tension that can arise from that activates the attachment system, which puts the person into overdrive to make the relationship work. And the feeling created in that reaction can get mixed up for feelings of like or love. And the other hard part is that if an anxious type meets someone who's secure and much better suited, the attachment system doesn't get activated. There's less drama, which can cause feelings of boredom. So if you're an anxious type, there's a good chance you'll automatically interpret calmness in the relationship as lack of attraction.
I would say Mark is like very comfortable with intimacy, and I'd say that you don't obsess where the relationship's going or my ability to love you back. I would say he's moved towards this.
Meaning secure attachment.
For me, I would probably have started out more with like having some insecurity about where the relationship was going and some of the things Mark did like really setting me off and driving me crazy. So more in the anxious and then gone more into the secure. We started in different boxes but ended up in the same one.
And that's exactly what can happen. Our attachment styles aren't fixed, thank goodness. They may lead us astray at points, but it's possible to develop a secure attachment at any age. Change occurs mostly when you get into a relationship that really shakes your beliefs about love. If, for example, you expect people to let you down or reject you once they get to know the real you, and then you meet someone who's supportive and loving no matter what, over time, you'll likely become more secure. So even though we don't have control over the type of attachment style that gets formed in infancy, we're not doomed.
I think I remember the turning point there. It was a discussion where we had where, I guess a lot of couples have that, they're like first fight, but then realizing that the person's going to stick through it. And I think that's where things probably kind of changed. Whereas in my previous relationships, it would have been like, okay, time to move on. Whereas this then was like, oh, okay, well, even if things are rough, this person's going to stick it out and we'll figure it out and work through it. I guess it just, for me, was not a pattern that I had been used to in my previous relationships. And so knowing that having a fight wasn't the end of the relationship was, I think, a really positive thing.
What was it that showed you, hey, this isn't going to be the end of us?
I think it was her reaction saying, you know, that we're not breaking up. Just even hearing that was a very good thing for me to hear. And I'm holding her to it now. And now we're at the point where I like talking about things a lot more than Eileen does.
Yeah, Mark's an excellent communicator.
I have to admit, I was disappointed by their story. Even a bit bored. Was that it? No big ups and downs. No big revelations. Just two people growing together and finally realizing their opposite traits are complementary. And then I realized I was still chasing excitement. If not through my own story, but through others. And it's not about excitement. It's about companionship, which can still involve excitement. Mark and Eileen have tons of fun together. They play, they joke. They're cool folks. In my own life, trying to break the pattern hasn't been easy. I've come up with the term dating in the middle to describe my experience. I'm trying not to run after fireworks, but I also need to feel something. So I guess that's the middle. But it's all still pretty new. When I meet someone nice and attractive enough, who I might not feel wildly excited about, I think, give this a chance. But also, I keep reminding myself that distance is my kryptonite. I think danger, stay away. But I'm still pulled towards it. It's not easy out there, especially when my compass has been stuck pointing north to emotionally unavailable men for years. It's going to take some time getting comfortable dating differently, but I think it might be worth it.
Part of my philosophy now in terms of being in a long committed relationship and my fear of missing out, you know, is that this is a great opportunity to have this lifelong commitment to someone. And if I'm not faithful, it will actually ruin that. And that's what I'm going to be missing out. I'd be missing out on a lifelong partner and building a life together with someone. And so it's just kind of turning it around, kind of using my weaknesses as a strength.
And so how many years in now?
11.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're close to 100% now too.
Witness the world's best cinema, meet the creators behind your favorite works, and encounter live shows that combine music and film at the Vancouver International Film Festival. Taking place from September 28th to October 8th, a stellar lineup of over 130 films from 70 countries will transport you to places you've never been. Embrace the magic of cinema with exceptional storytelling that leaves you captivated and inspired. Be in the room as VIFF Live shows breathe life into stories from the screen, combining live performance and cinema. And go behind the scenes with VIFF Talks, connecting you to the brilliant minds behind the work you love. Explore the program and get tickets now at VIFF.org. That's VIFF.org. Student discounts are available, and if you are between the ages of 19 and 25, you can also join VIFF's free U25 membership program.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.